Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Clear from this point on in the statement that they are beginning to now really look at critics of the church and some of the soundbite kind of caricaturizations of our teachings from here on. So the first question they address next is, does this make us polytheists? And I'm going to do an entire podcast on the nature of God's sin, so we're going to just skip that right here. I'll just kind of let our listeners know to watch in the next month. We'll have a good one about, are we polytheists? Are we henotheists? Are we multitheists? Isn't that your word, I think, Richard?
I don't know what word to use. You've got to use plural or pluri or multi or something like that.
Monaltry, are we monaltrous?
Yeah, whatever it is, you got to include monaltry. One divine being. Yep. So
you got to throw in kenotheism, though.
Henotheism. Yeah,
not henotheism.
Kenotheism.
Kenotheism. It's a term that Max Müller created for India.
That's right.
To worship one god at a time.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
You love the one you're with. You know.
And I'll definitely do a whole podcast with it. And imagine that some of you guys, it might even be all three of you that will bring on when I do that one. But that's down the road. So let's not deal with that now.
Yeah, that was the Hindologist 19th century Max Müller, not the Mormon Max Müller, who's
okay.
Got a great name though for religious studies.
Okay, fun. So we'll skip that section. It's just three paragraphs in the statement. And then, Charlie, the next one is, how do Latter-day Saints envision exaltation? And this is, I think the first couple paragraphs are quite interesting here of how they set us up for, you know, really addressing, does this mean planets? You know, so would
Again,
you take
can
us?
I, can I answer a quick question right here? Because I think it fits. And that is, Charlie, well, it's two questions. The first question is, when does this, what I refer to as this strong notion of godhood, first start to take shape after Joseph Smith? Is it the early 1850s? Is it Orson Pratt and Brigham Young and what they're doing when they're trying to first defend publicly polygamy? Is that when we start to see this really take shape for the first time? But I guess my question is, it looks like there's a section missing in this essay. And the section that's missing is from 1850-ish to 1990-ish, somewhere in there. I don't know, right? So there's a huge, huge section gone that represents what all four of us grew up with. And Charlie, I wonder, when did that first emerge? What we grew up with, the four of us talking here?
That's a good question. I haven't examined that real closely, but it appears to me that that began shortly after the death of Joseph Smith, because we do have Lorenzo Snow's couplet that to him meant just what the couplet says, that we can become gods in every sense of the word, that God is God, because he was once like we were. So you get that in Joseph Smith. He taught it very plainly in the King Follett discourse that we can become God. God was once a man, and so the whole implication there is we can become just like God is. And section 132, which was given in 1843, that kind of puts the nail in the coffin there, saying that those who become exalted are gods. And you know, it's kind of, they reign as gods and sit on their thrones, not sit on the throne with God, but sit on their own throne So it makes it pretty explicit there, I think. Now, whether or not they understood it in terms of, oh, we can become like God because we are the spirit offspring of God, as I say, I don't think that was there, at least in the records, in the literature of 1843, 1844, but by 1845, that was there. So in my mind, the fully developed idea was there. And Orson Pratt taught this very strongly throughout 1845. Of course, in November 1845 is when you get Eliza R. Snow's hymn. And so I think that's the idea that was really rooted in that time period. And that is what that is the concept, the doctrine that has persisted on through to, like you say, the 1990s, whenever. The only thing that may be added there would be some of the ideas about the plurality of wives that God may have.
Right, because that was there throughout the 19th century.
Yes, right? Yeah. And I think that also came very soon with the whole idea of Section 132 was the idea that Abraham was going to reign as a god with his wives, right? I mean, so I think the idea was of everything that we embraced for the last century and a half was in place by 1845, from everything I can see, anyway.
Could I say something for Divine Sex?
Yeah.
In the autobiography of Mark Twain that, you know, came out a couple of years ago, Twain says that he finds it so odd that Christianity doesn't put the most pleasant activity we do here on earth in heaven. So, yeah.
Yeah. Unless you were Swedenborg, he put it there.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
That was, and he said it was much more enjoyable than we can even imagine.
Well, I saw the movie Cocoon, and that sure looked good. Remember that scene?
Yeah.
Anyway, fun stuff. Okay, good. So is that enough, Richard, or is there more?
Yeah, it is. I just wanted to make sure, because like I said, there's a complete section missing from the essay, and it's a pretty glaring hole because it's exactly what's at the heart of this tension that, you know, brought us together to talk about this, I think.
Right, and it's actually what you're talking to is the main focus of a blog post that all four of us are aware of that actually came out today that they were recording called Lying for the Lord? It's at Rational Face, and it's by Corbin Voluz. I don't know how to say his last name, Volluz. And he's basically quoting extensively, you know, from different sections during this period that you're saying here, and he's basically saying they have omitted this completely and just pretending that these teachings were never quite as strongly stated as they were.
Well, and what's interesting to me is, so I've got on my screen here, on one tab, I've got Lying for the Lord, and this, from everything I can tell, this is the first time I've read this blog. I really don't know anything about this person, but just reading through it, my sense is this is a committed, practicing member of the church, and he's very, very frustrated. I could be wrong, but it looks to me like this is somebody who still has commitments anyway, and they're frustrated.
The subtitle of the blog is Keeping Mormonism Weird.
it's a great blog. It's a great blog.
I just was going to mention on one tab I've got that open, and then on another tab I've got a very similar presentation from the Mormonism Research Ministry. They're engaging the very same question, the essay, Becoming Like God, and they're actually making the same point. They're obviously coming at it from an anti-Mormon point of view. This person, if they are a faithful or a committed member, they're coming at it from a member's point of view, and both essays are expressing frustration over, you know, what we're going to be talking about next, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to let you know that Corbin's bio at the bottom says that he's been researching a lot, and he has published in Journal of Book of Mormon Studies as well as BYU Studies. So clearly he generally passes a constructive approach kind of practice if he's publishing in there. Cool. Okay, so those, there is a big hole here, but then the statement really is probably why they even did the statement to begin with, is they're basically trying to handle the Book of Mormon musical and the lyric of, you know, God says I get my own planet someday, and just sort of the soundbite that, you know, started to appear in all the election cycles and stuff like that when Mitt Romney was running. And that seems to be their main focus here towards the end of this whole piece, is just to kind of calm down off that. Let's nuance it a little bit better. But I do like how they began that section. So we'll say, yes, they left out a whole chunk of showing just exactly how much it was taught. But when they do get to sort of the conceptions of reality, when you start to think of heavens and things like that, they start to talk about how inexpressible these things are to begin with. So Charlie, is that a prime to get you to talk about them?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah. So thanks. Pick up.
Yeah. In fact, that post a lying for the Lord, and that echoes what people have been discussing for several months now, since, in fact, it's probably over a year, when the Newsroom article came out, right, where it talked about, asked the explicit question, will we have our own planet, you know, in the hereafter? And the answer was simply no.
Right. And it's just one paragraph. It says, no, this idea is not taught in Latter-day Saint Scripture, nor it is a doctrine of the church. This misunderstanding stems from speculative comments unreflective of scriptural doctrine. Mormons believe that we are all sons and daughters of God, and that all of us have the potential to grow during and after this life to become like our Heavenly Father. The church does not and has never purported to fully understand the specific of Christ's statement that in my Father's house are many mansions. And that's the extent of that whole post.
Which is interesting, when Joseph Smith actually explained that passage, saying that what Jesus meant was, in my Father's mansion, or my Father's house, are many kingdoms.
Right.
And so we can all get a kingdom kind of implication.
Charlie, are you going to take up this question a little bit right now of the caricature, the idea of whether it represents a caricature, or will we come back to that?
I at least want to get to this second paragraph of this last section,
because
again, this is where I'm not nearly as upset as Corbin on this thing, as because I've never felt like that whenever we declare anything, we've got it nailed down. We've got it fully fleshed out here, and this is something I've always been, maybe at least, I can't say always, but you know, since I've started to trust my own mystical experiences, my own connection with God, I'm more of a guy that just settles into the gist of a teaching rather than the actual language of the teaching. You know, I like where it points and things like that. And I do like at least how they take these first couple paragraphs of this section and sort of say, you cannot capture this in words. Go ahead, Charlie. Would you start in on that second paragraph?
Yeah. I've highlighted that second paragraph because I think it really explains the caricature, because it makes the analogy of how in traditional Christianity, it's the idea of the caricature of playing a harp. And so the image in the cartoons that, you know, sometimes are portrayed as when you pass through the pearly gates, you're handed a harp. And, you know, that's the caricature. And I think they're trying to draw the same comparison with the idea of, oh, when I get exalted, I'm going to get my own planet. Like, oh, here you go. Here's your planet.
Yeah. Isn't God Makers, it's almost like that, and it's kind of got a sneer in it. But, you know, the one, I don't know where I picked it up, but somewhere along the line, it's like Oprah on the day that she gives away everything, and you get a car, and you get a car, and it's almost like the sort of the cartoon image is, and you get a planet, and you get a planet, and everybody's, you know, freaking out in the audience that they get their own planet. And that's sort of, I think, what the church is just trying to fight against.
Yeah. And so coming to the second paragraph, let's look at the comparison they're making. They say, a cloud and harp are hardly a satisfying image for eternal joy, although most Christians would agree that inspired music can be a tiny foretaste of the joy of eternal salvation. So in other words, there is something to the harp. It is at least symbolic, if not literally, going to be realized with maybe celestial music, you know, the joy of eternal salvation. So they're not saying that heaven has nothing to do with a harp in traditional Christianity. Then likewise, it says, while few Latter-day Saints would identify with caricatures of having their own planet, most would agree that the awe inspired by creation hints at our creative potential in the eternities. So when I read that, I see in that that, oh, you mean if I look around at what we believe God has created, that that is a foretaste of the creative potential that I can have in the eternities? So I guess I come down a little closer to where Dan is on this, that I appreciate the fact that they're not spelling it all out in detail of exactly what it entails, but certainly it involves and includes the same creative sorts of acts that God himself participates in. Now, yeah, I might be reading more into that than what's there, but that's how I read it.
I actually like that, too, this notion of a co-creativity, the potential to participate in a co-creativity with God is, I think, a beautiful image. And I think it's an image that we can hang on to talk about our situation here and now to a certain extent and our situation hereafter. There's a certain sense in which you might say one lives an eternal life to the extent that they participate in this co-creative activity with God. And in that sense, we would be living eternal lives right now, and that's what we would be striving for. So I think it's a beautiful image. My only concern is I feel like it has the potential, and I noted this in my own post, to be a bit disingenuous, because Latter-day Saints have talked for well over 100 years about creating their own worlds. And so if you replace having their own planets with creating their own worlds, then you actually have the very words that we've been using to describe what goes on in the hereafter for a very, very long time. And I just worry because people use the shorthand, and it's kind of, it's pejorative. There's no question when people, most of the time when people use this phrase, having your own planets, is intended to be used in a kind of negative way, or at least most commonly it seems like it's used in a negative way. But I've always felt like it's certainly points to what it is we do say, which is creating our own worlds.
Well, I think, you know, if we put this paragraph together with the next one, it hits on a really central issue here, that, you know, the point of any kind of caricature, you know, think of a political caricature, is that there's some truth to it. And certainly, you know, you can see the negative view of the Mormon desire to be God would be to become a master of the universe, to create your own worlds, to govern your own worlds, to be, you know, Lord over all things. But that's the other guy. That was supposedly Lucifer's plan to, you know, have that kind of power. And so in this next paragraph, we get the idea to imagine exaltation through the lens of the sacred and mortal experience, and that, you know, they end that paragraph with the idea of sociality, and, you know, I think, you know, the danger with a good deal of the way we, you know, the kind of idea of creating worlds that we grew up with, which I love. But it does have the tendency, at least among some of us, to fall into this kind of idea of self-glorification, which I think what I really like about these two paragraphs is they're pushing us away from that.
Right. It's, what do they actually say? It's not about what they will get. You know, Mormons, members don't imagine exaltation about what they will get, and instead it's more through relationships they have now and how these relationships might be purified and elevated, you know, and then as the DNC scripture talks about, the same sociality which exists among us here will exist among us there, etc. And so I'm with you, Jim. I think it's great. And again, this is sort of, it mirrors the shift that happened in me in the last 15 or so years, where I just quit even worrying about anything other than the richness of experience sort of coming into me, and it's always through relationality. It's always, you know, all the growth as well as all the pain, of course, and the things that cause growth is just opening to more relations. And, you know, to section 88 in the 20s into the 30s of the verses, it talks about celestial glory not as a place, it's not a kingdom that you go to so much as it's an embodiment of you. And so things had already shifted for me there. I think those teachings are already within Mormonism, but everybody's right that's saying so far, yeah, we used to be really explicit on this planet and creating your own worlds and things like that, but I think those with a more mystical bent, or those who just really began to think about it in terms of gist and what the gospel points towards, would say that what they're focusing on here is the more solid teaching. You know, again, I can never get away from, oh, if I do my home teaching 100% and if I'm righteous this, and it's all about, like you guys are saying, it's about, you know, achievement and accomplishment, then I get a reward of a planet. Man, those people aren't ready for planets. It's, you know, it's those who've really decided, I'm going to love like God. I'm going to open myself up to pain and people and agents that don't do what I want them to do. You know, I would that they would choose this, but they choose that. And it's people like that. Those are the ones that, you know, would be naturally stepping into a planet running kind of, you know, situation versus the others.
I'd like to make an observation. I agree with you, Dan and Jim, with the idea that I think this is a nobler way to think about deification, rather than, you know, what we can get, you know, what we can become and who we can become and the kinds of relationships that we can nourish. But I think coming back to Richard's point, while I like the way that it's being articulated here, and I like the direction that the church is going with their doctrine, I disagree with the way that they're getting there by just throwing the past under the bus or pretending that it didn't exist or didn't happen.
It never happened.
And I think that's where Richard's saying there is a hole here, a big gap, a huge gap. We have just suddenly jumped from the time of Joseph Smith to, yeah, and so based on all these teachings, this is what we believe today. But that isn't what the implications of Joseph Smith's teachings were and what the follow-on teachings were for the next 150 years.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, very, very well said, Charlie. And I agree, Dan and Jim. I think this way, this much more open. I think open is one way I'd look at it. Open and relational theology, right? This is actually a school of thought, but this feels to me much more open and relational. And it's something that I share with you. I deeply resonate with. It's one of the reasons why I'm attracted to process thought as well. But back to the matter at hand is this question of how this is presented by the church and what this does mean ultimately in terms of becoming mothers and fathers in heaven. Do human beings have the potential to become mothers and fathers in heaven? I think the essay seems to say yes. But does that then mean, and here's the question that this essay doesn't address it, but it's the question I always ask people who are interested in this and people who, you know, this is sort of my litmus test. And I will say something like this. Do you think that human beings have the potential to become worthy of worship? Do human beings have the potential to become beings who are worshiped by their spirit offspring? And that's when you ask it in that specific way, I've actually been surprised over the past 10 years or so at how many people have said, actually, no.
Push back a little bit, something Charlie said, even though I think I might agree completely with what Charlie said, but I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
When I read B.H. Roberts' Mormon Doctrine of Deity or John A. Witsow's A Rational Theology, I get the really concrete image of, you know, creating worlds and all of those things. But I also get this idea of sociality. I don't think that they're I think they're emphasizing an idea that's always been there. Now, certainly in the 19th century, you have both of these notions, like, you know, women wanting to marry somebody or be sealed to somebody of a higher status than their husbands, or people during the law of adoption being insulted if somebody asked them to adopt into their kingdom when they perceive themselves as higher than the guy in the other kingdom. You know, that, I mean, that happens. But I don't think that that's the only thing that's there. That's certainly the sociality, the idea of cooperation and co-creation is I think, at the heart of a good deal of 19th and 20th century Mormonism up to 1990. What concerns me, you know, going back to what Richard said, is just that idea that a lot of Mormons don't think that you should, anybody other than the father, you know, in this kind of monarcho-theism thing is worthy of worship. I've always looked at Mormonism as a kind of ancestor veneration, so, you know, I'd hate to lose that.
Yeah, and I would certainly agree that the relational aspect has always been there. I don't see that as having diminished at all. And if anything, it's being strengthened, but it's certainly not a new concept. I would totally agree with that.
Cool. Well, the rest of the piece...
Dan, before we leave the sociology section, it's probably important that we say something about Blake Osler and his idea of monarchism.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Those ideas. Okay.
Please.
Well, Blake, and if Blake's listening, he can write me and tell me all the places I get him wrong. Blake takes the position, and perhaps Richard and Charlie can correct me too, but Blake takes the position that there is a sense in which God has always been God, and that makes him different than human beings who become gods. There's a sense in which Christ has always been Christ, and the way Blake phrases it in the last volume, Volume 3 of God and Gods, is that there is a slight ontological difference between the Godhead and humanity, that we only become gods through God's action, whereas God is God from eternity. That's I think a kind of more nuanced and a really kind of sophisticated view of some of the idea, if you were going to just talk about becoming like God instead of the view that, as Richard said, we all grew up with, that that goes more along with, I think, with Lorenzo Snow's couplet, that as man is, God once was, and as God is, man may become.
Right, it's not parallel paths. Go ahead, Richard or Charlie, any more on Blake's thing? Because there's more to it than what Jim just said.
Yeah, I don't mind saying a few things. It's important to point out that Blake really, his view is a sophisticated expression of what I think the New Church essay represents. I think Blake's view is perfectly in line with the New Church essay. And it's interesting because when I read the Church essay, I said to myself, well, here's another example, because I have a few people in mind when I use the phrase weaker or softer notion of deification, and Blake's at the top of the list, because for him, he says, look, we don't I've got his book sitting here in front of me, and it's the last two chapters in his book where he takes this up, but he says we don't become like God just because you mature in the sense that a son or daughter becomes like the parent. You know, a lot of times, because we do use the parent-child language to talk about this, we can too easily assume that just growing up, all you got to do is grow up, you become a god. You know, and it's too easy to have this sense. And he says, no, we are definitely alienated human beings. And maybe a better way to conceive of this, an analogy he uses, the analogy of water, where he says that, look, by themselves, you know, oxygen or hydrogen are very different sorts of things. But when you combine them, when you bring them into a certain kind of relationship to each other, they become a different kind of substance. And that's his metaphor for talking about how human beings can become divine. Deity is just a certain kind of relationship of a certain kind of beings. And so he's very resistant to the idea that human beings could ever become. Well, let me step back and say, when you read Blake Osler, you've got to read very, very carefully, because he never actually says this. I've asked him in private exchanges, well, online exchanges, and so I've got him to actually say explicitly, but in his book, he doesn't say this explicitly, but he does reject the idea that human beings could ever become worship worthy. So the way he phrases it in the book, he gives several different ways of expressing his view that he calls this robust deification. And one view that he rejects, he says, look, if it's not true, it's not accurate, if what you mean are humans as individuals become the same kind of being as God, it's not that simple, but it is accurate. You know, if you just say we become the kind of being that God is, just gods, goddesses, and this kind of simplistic way that a lot of us have thought about it in Mormonism, he says, no, this is more what I have in mind. He says, humans perfected in the love of Christ become the same kind of being as gods, to the extent that they are in a relationship of a fullness of, and he uses technical language here, but they're in a relationship of a fullness of indwelling unity with the Father through Christ. Right. And so what Blake spends most of his time fleshing out, and it's really not, it's only 10 or 15 pages that gets at the core of his argument, that when human beings enter into this kind of relationship with God, they partake of the fullness of divinity, even though they don't become exactly what God is. So anyway, I'll leave it at there. Maybe Charlie can pick up a few other pieces.
Yeah, you're right, Richard, that this is something he only handles in 10 or 15 pages, but it's something that really runs through all three volumes.
Yes.
It's there. It's very much present. And it's very much in his, if you read earlier in the volume, it's very much in his kind of idiosyncratic reading of the King Follett discourse as well.
At the opening chapter takes up the part of the couplet, as man is, God once was. He takes that up in chapter one, and then it's like a bookend, you know, here towards the end of the book, he takes up the other part of the couplet where, as God is, man may become.
In fact, he favors one of the scribes, you know, one set of notes against the other two.
I agree wholeheartedly that it's a very idiosyncratic reading. I don't know very many people who buy into it, but Blake's a sophisticated thinker, so you got to take him seriously.
Charlie, anything on Blake's theology that important for you to mention?
So, yeah, as I read Blake Osler, he strikes me as being a systematic theologian, in that he takes the whole corpus of teachings and doctrinal teachings in particular, and tries to find the unifying thread through all of them to get them to harmonize. And in particular, you know, you have to deal with some of these early teachings in the church in the Revelations, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, about God being God from all eternity to all eternity, you know, kind of teaching. So as soon as you embrace that teaching and you make the assumption that doctrines need to be consistent and harmonious, then how do you explain the King Follett discourse in light of the teaching of the eternality of God as God? Right. So that's what strikes me is what is going on there. And I think this gets back at the same issue we've been talking about of, you know, if you can accept scripture and doctrine as evolving, then there's a storyline going on here rather than fitting it all together, flattening it out into a single uniform view. So,
yeah, no, awesome. One thing there that, you know, with Charlie, when he was talking, and Richard too, talking about, you know, grabbing things from other religious traditions to help us along with things like that. There are, in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in, you know, so many different ideas, because these people have confronted a lot of the same issues that help you appropriate statements like from eternity to eternity, and yet we grow into it. You know, we become what we already were or something. You know, there's so many ways that we could think about these things that would be helpful that we don't generally do yet.
Awesome sidebar. Thanks so much. I'm glad that you brought that up, Jim, and thanks for the discussion on Blake. All right, let's get back to the statement. The rest of the piece has a couple paragraphs on the atonement and how, you know, how important the teachings are about exaltation to Latter-day Saints, etc. And it just kind of closes with that sort of stuff. But the overriding concern here, guys, is as we've been, let's get to the end of this.
Hey, Dan, before we get to the very end, I would like to make one comment about that section that you just referred to, where it talks about the importance of this LDS teaching of deification on other doctrines and its impact on these doctrines.
Okay.
And in particular, as you pointed out, its impact on the doctrine of the atonement. And it makes a statement here that I'm not sure is totally valid in terms of its caricature of other religious faiths. It says, while many Christian theologians have expressed the magnitude of the Savior's atonement by emphasizing human depravity, in other words, what it's saying here is that most Christians view the atonement in terms of rescuing us from the fall, overcoming human depravity, and that's it. And it stops there. Latter-day Saints, it says, understand the magnitude of the atonement of Christ in terms of the vast human potential it makes possible. In other words, once you've gotten back to ground level here, level zero, ground zero, now we're going to elevate you up to a higher ground. And it's kind of suggesting that that idea is not present in other Christian theologies. So it says Christ's atonement not only provides forgiveness from sin and victory over death, but it also redeems imperfect relationships, heals the spiritual wounds that stifle growth, and strengthens and enables individuals to develop the attributes of Christ. So that's a beautiful expression of the atonement, but it bothers me a bit, it concerns me, that we always have to contrast it with other religions as though nobody else thinks this way about the atonement. Okay. Is that a valid concern?
No, I think it is, Charlie, because I'm not aware of a single Christian theologian or person that I know who is a non-Mormon Christian who would who could not accept what was written there. So, yeah, I think absolutely other Christians share the exact same sensibility that not only are we rescued from the fall, but that we have that our ultimate destiny lies with God, and the only way that we achieve that objective is through the atonement of Jesus Christ, through his suffering and death on the cross. So, yeah, I think they have that same sensibility, both rescued from the fall and being brought fully back into the presence of God and sharing and being partakers of the divine nature.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole New Testament teaching.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for doing that. Okay, guys, so we're now assigned to write the doctrine of becoming like gods here. These guys are obviously walking a tightrope, and I think, Richard, your blog post makes a pretty good argument for it. Clearly seems like they are trying to preserve as much continuity as possible and eliminate the idea that this is changed, you know, emphases, change doctrine and like that. So I think you've made that point very clear. The question is, and I'll let you articulate it here, is does this feed into more fragility of faith or less? And again, don't forget that with the blacks and the priesthood statement, where they were pretty open about we got it wrong, some people did fall apart, you know, showing that there is fragility already.
Well, I think that's precisely part of what's at issue here. What's at question? Because some people would say that they didn't. That's not what that statement on race actually says. The statement on race is so well crafted that the person who is an extreme critic can come away saying, "See, this proves what I've been saying all along. The church leaders were mistaken for decades on this issue, and you know, they proceed to make their point. On the other hand, I've got close relatives who live in a much more conservative or traditional worldview, and they come away reading that statement on race feeling like, see, this confirms that how inspired all of the prophets have been all along from the time of Joseph Smith through Thomas S. Monson. So it's very well written, and you can come away with the sense that there weren't any mistakes made. And one of the reasons why you come away with the reason there weren't any mistakes made is because it doesn't refer to all of the justifications for the priesthood ban as doctrines, but it refers to them as theories.
That's a big point.
It's a serious problem, because anybody who's done even a little bit of reading on this knows full well that these were absolutely viewed by both leaders and members alike as doctrines. So the larger question then is, obviously the statement goes on to repudiate those ideas, but the larger question that's applicable, both it's the Book of Mormon and DNA, it's this becoming like God, it's this question of change. You know, what degree of change does this represent? Because they've tried to do the best they can to engage these questions. This is the tightrope. They have to present something devotional. Two, they have to engage the issue at a fairly sophisticated level to try and respond to the issue they're trying to respond to. And they have to make some adjustments. You know, the third thing is they recognize they've got to make some adjustments. But they make adjustments in a way that the church usually makes adjustments, and that is, we just stop talking about it. And there's example after example that we could talk about, and one approach to dealing with difficult issues is to just stop talking. And it seems to me that this Becoming Like God essay might represent one of those, where they are softly pushing for change by simply letting go of the past. Notice what they didn't include. That's what I meant by the holes there. So they leave it out. And right. My takeaway is, this absolutely represents a change. It's not nearly as dramatic, not nearly as drastic, but it seems to be a change. It's probably a change for the better. I think the four of us would agree that it's probably overall, in terms of theology, a change for the better. But what does this mean in terms of the faith of the average member? So when they see this and they come across these things and they confront change for the first time, are they going to react something like what we see from Corbin Vallues or the many other people or this other individual? I'm going to read this comment and then you guys can kind of take it from there. But this is a comment to the blog post, Lying for the Lord. And again, I don't think we were clear enough, but on this blog post, but his he gave example after example trying to demonstrate why he just grew up with this belief that we would get our own planets. He's like, how is this a caricature? This doesn't make sense to me that they're calling this a caricature. I just grew up with this. I asked my wife, do Latter-day Saints believe that one day we'll get their own planet? His wife answers straight out, yes. He goes on a little bit later in a comment to say his daughter says the same thing. He then proceeds to provide quote after quote of church leader indicating that, only the verbiage is again creating worlds. So he's bothered. He's troubled by what looks to be a major doctrinal change. I mean, we are talking about godhood here, right? So if this is a major doctrinal change, then how should we handle that? How should we view it? Are they lying? Because if they know what church leaders have said in the past and they know what's in certain manuals, and this is true, it's still in certain manuals today, are they lying? He's actually seems to be accusing them of lying. He's not just raising the question. So lying for the Lord, right? So is this an example of lying for the Lord, sort of a justified lie? At a minimum, my own personal sense is you'd probably say it's a bit disingenuous by not being as frank and open about where the church was in the past. But what ends up happening is, because this feeds into this idea that doctrines are eternal and unchanging, you have a statement like this. And here's the comment from Sarah Broadway Clark. She says, "The Becoming Like God essay was the straw that broke my camel's back." So obviously she's been troubled by other things, but still, this is the straw that broke my camel's back and led me to officially end my membership in the church. Whether it's lying, splitting hairs, or a change in doctrine, this was not handled in a way becoming of leaders taking their direction from Christ. If this is the true church on the earth, there would be no need for spin, for doublespeak, or any other PR trick the church is using in these essays. And if this were the true church, it wouldn't throw good, faithful members under the bus, telling the world that these people just misunderstood or created folk doctrine, when in fact these people were believing what they'd been taught from the pulpit by prophets, seers, and revelators they'd been told could never lead them astray. Someone in general conference this past weekend talked about people going online and then doubting their faith because they've waded into garbage, in quotes, garbage. The funny thing for me is that I lost my testimony reading LDS.org and Fair Mormon and realizing I couldn't do the mental gymnastics needed to believe all the contradictions. And then she just finishes off, by their fruits, ... And, you know, I think this is sort of the heart of what's at stake in this conversation. And that is, I don't want to use the word mature and immature faith. I've used it already and it makes me nervous because I don't want to accuse anyone of having a kind of naive faith. And I just don't know better words for it, but I'm trying to use words to describe things rather than be pejorative about things, because I'm really not trying to be pejorative. But it seems to me this expectation that things don't change really sets people up to fall. All right, I'll stop there. I'll leave that alone, and you see what you guys have to say about it.
Jump in, guys.
So maybe let me just be a little clear. I said it probably stronger than I intended to, and that is I don't mean that the idea of eternal unchanging doctrine automatically leads to people to have a naive faith. It's to say that we've all seen example after example of people who have ended up walking away from their faith. They've left the community entirely because they've been confronted with the notion of change, and all their life they were taught that things don't change. And it looks like we've got some pretty solid examples of things changing, and that thus we have a kind of fragile faith, more fragile than I think it needs to be or should be.
Right.
Well, that's, you know, certainly one of the dilemmas that, and I think it's actually sort of a false dilemma that has been created for us. Charlie talks about this in his stuff, that we look back. Here we have a church that claims to have continuing revelation, that claims to be growing in that sense, and yet at the same time says that, well, it was always the same. And I guess you want to say that, yeah, there are some things that were always the same, that, you know, maybe revelation or itself, or that people can connect with God, but our understanding of it, you know, even at the most basic level, you know, it seems to change all the time. And yet what people want to believe, and I think this is a kind of a basic for people, is that they can grab onto something that's absolutely changeless and secure against the you know, the scary world that's out there that's changing all the time. I think this is just, you know, we've lived through this with homosexuality, certainly, and but also with the, you know, the change in the doctrine about the extension of priesthood to African Americans. Well, excuse me, to people of African origin. Beyond that, so it's. Yeah, it's we all want this kind of security, to think that somebody's absolutely changeless and knows what they're doing. But you know, I mean, that's why we, from a Mormon point of view, we could say that's why we got the doctrine of creation ex nihilo in the first place, the desire to have this kind of changeless, eternal perfection.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And it is a little bit ironic that we have a theological understanding that we have, right? An embodied God. Like, if God is in God's self, to use the theological language, if God in God's self, Heavenly Father is embodied in, I struggle for the right words, but if he's embodied as we are embodied, encased in flesh and bone, he lives somewhere, somewhen. And, yeah. you know, he lives within time and space. And anything that lives within time and space is, by definition, becoming, undergoing constantly the process of becoming, change, right? So there's right. there's anything.
Which is what I love about Mormonism more than almost any other doctrine.
It's probably what led all three of us to process thought, right? Because it has such a robust notion, right, that we recognize that, wow, something seems to resonate here. There's clearly some important differences, but something resonates here, right? And so it seems like if our theology, that is our understanding of God as changing, right, clearly Bruce R. McConkie and, if you want to use the term neo-orthodoxy, that school of thought is resistant to change in a strong sense, but if you're open to change in the way that Brigham Young seemed to be and B.H. Roberts seemed to be, then it would seem to me this might help us flesh out an idea of doctrine that actually reflects God, him, and herself, and help us to maybe overcome the resistance that we have to doctrinal disparity. You know, these changes, we would expect right. changes from a divine being who changes with us and through us and for us, right, and responds to us in these kinds of ways.
And gotcha. It seems that, is Charlie going to say, go ahead, Charlie.
Well, I was just going to say, I've heard theologians, LDS theologians also talk about that aspect of the embodied God, that as you take that to the logical conclusion, you know, it's almost absurd where, when you think about the fact that most of the aspects of our physical makeup are to accommodate our mortal condition. And, you know, what does that even mean then to say that God has a body like us in any meaningful sense? So it even goes beyond the being somewhere and some when. It's what does he do with this digestive system and this heart and circulatory? You know, what meaning does that even have? What function could it possibly serve?
It's a really good point. Really good point, Jerome.
Yeah.
Jim, jump back in.
Yeah, I can't remember what I was going to say. So,
well, while you're thinking about that, I've got a couple of comments about the idea, the concept we're talking about with changing doctrine, and I think this comes full circle back to how we started the conversation in talking about how does the church deal with this, with the cognitive dissonance where we talk about God being unchanging and his word being infallible and those doctrines we've been taught as we've grown up in the church. And now to say that it changes, wow. I mean, that is a radical admission to make. And I'm reminded of President Uchtdorf's comment in a recent general conference where he said, leaders have said things in the past that aren't consistent with our doctrine. And I'm wondering, what does that say about our doctrine? When, right. you know, isn't that our doctrine, the things that our leaders have said in the past? And it's just kind of interesting how, in the comment is made, how we tend to distance ourselves from things that were said in the past when we want to move beyond them. We want to just kind of put them back in the past. We don't want to deal with them head on, like in a mature fashion, like we should.
Yeah, and, sure. I'm sorry.
Well, I just, the only other comment is that I think some of our Protestant neighbors have dealt with this more constructively than we have. And Dan, this goes back to this idea of, you know, the incarnational view of Scripture and so forth, where people right. have tried to find, it's not that you have to say, okay, doctrines change, what we've taught in the past doesn't mean anything anymore, and nothing is known for certain anymore, but instead you try to reframe everything that we've, the way that we've thought about doctrine in the past, the way that we've thought about revelation and prophets and so forth, so that we deal with it constructively. But as it is, the church has put us in this bind of you either accept it or you reject it, and there is no middle ground, no middle way to deal with it.
I think that is one of the, I wrote another happy to post here on Peculiar People about this question of the title, very uninviting title, but the Discourse of Dichotomy. And it was about this, and I tried to do the same thing, raise questions about whether or not it makes sense to actually buy into these dichotomies. I think in the end, they're ultimately false dichotomies. But Charlie, you said something that reminded me of an experience that I had here at Claremont early on. And, you know, I ended up here for a couple of different reasons. One, it was a good fit because I was interested in philosophy of religion. Another, because of the process thought thing, but also Mormon studies was going to be starting. And I thought, you know, I may not be doing a PhD in Mormon studies, but I certainly would like to be around and be involved in any way that I can. And during the first year, we had a lot of people come, as many as we could. We probably had more than we should have, but one of the people we had here was Rick Turley. And for our listeners who don't know who Rick Turley is, he's one of the, I don't know what his actual title is now.
Managing director of the
Church History Department, but he's sort of the second man on the totem pole in the History Department. And he was in the same position then that he's in now, working then with Marla Jensen, but he came to speak on the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And that was his topic for the public lecture that he gave. And this was actually just preceding the release of the book that he co-wrote on Mountain Meadows. And what his whole presentation was on various responses to what he called the worst event in Mormon history, the worst event. And he said, let me just go through some of the ways in which we have traditionally responded to the worst event. We have denied it. We have tried to minimize it. We have tried to ignore it. And I think he went through a couple of others. So he did four or five different ways, and sort of negative ways that we responded to it. And then he said, here's how I think that we should respond to it. And I haven't listened to it for a long time, so I'm going to be just paraphrasing significantly here. But he said something to the effect that the most constructive, productive way to respond to even the worst moments in our past or most difficult times would be to just confront them, face them head on, and let whatever evidence flows out of whatever we find, whatever skeleton is in the closet, whatever we discover, to confront it head on, to acknowledge it and deal with it as openly, honestly, frankly as possible. And I raised my hand, but time ran out, so I couldn't ask the question in front of the audience. So I walked up to him afterwards and I said, I've been thinking here when I listen to you and how you feel like this would be the ideal response for the Mountain Meadows Massacre. I said, can you think of any reason why we shouldn't respond in exactly the way you're describing to any crisis, historical, theological, cultural, any crisis at all? Is there any reason you can think of why we shouldn't respond in exactly the way you've outlined? And he looked at me and kind of smiled and said, well, of course, I can't speak for anyone but myself, but no. And if that's right, then my suggestion here that, look, embracing the reality of radical doctrinal change, yes, there's no doubt about it. Initially disorienting, very disconcerting. But I think that's the short term. I think in the long term, you end up with something that's much stronger, much more robust, much more, you know, it more closely actually coheres with what we see in our individual lives and our lives together as a religious community. And so It aligns with the messiness and the complexity and the evolution of religious belief. Anybody who spends time studying various religious traditions would quickly recognize is we're not alone in this. This happens for every tradition goes through these kinds of things. And so I feel like the more open and the more frank that we can be, the more we can reduce the shock and the suffering and the pain. And that's what I'm interested in is reducing unnecessary suffering. So.
Amen.
Very cool. Now, some said that President Uchtdorf's talk, not this conference, but the previous one, where about leaders made mistakes, was in some ways, you know, preparing the ground for the statement on race. And then I began to start hearing people talk about his talk this time in priesthood session about, you know, is the restoration over? Did it happen, or is it ongoing? As sort of another, you know, whether he's a gang of one or whether he's by assignment, you know, preparing the ground here. Some people have seen that as preparing a way for more movement on the women in the church and priesthood ordination, possibly stuff, some movement on GLBT stuff and things like that. So do you guys read those in that way at all? And that Richard, in other words, there is at least somebody there in a church leadership position who probably agrees with you, but yet sees that there needs to be some more preparation in order to get to that good result.
One thing about that talk is he started out quoting Martin Luther King, which
was, yeah, that was, you know, awesome. Yeah,
don't sleep through the revolution, which, you know,
right,
a great way to, you know, and then he goes to don't sleep through the restoration. And, you know, when you think about, you know, the idea of a changeless God, going back to what Charlie said, you know, the Mormon attitude, well, you know, there's so many different ones, but one way to look at it is, you know, you go back to Exodus 3:14, and, you know, the traditional translation was, I am that I am, and Augustine loved that because you have a God in eternity is incapable of change. But then Rashi, in the 12th century, read it, I will be who I will be. So, you know, there you have an idea of a God who's, you know, process people like that. I mean, and most recently, Richard Carney read it, I will be there for you, which is a kind of nice idea that God is always with us. Now, I'm remembering the point I wanted to make a little while ago was going back to that idea, that, and then I think that you know, this works into what Uchtdorf is saying, that go back to the point I made at the beginning about Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, Freudian Hamlet, being an excellent Hamlet, is that what you're claiming is that you found in those revelations a fuller meaning, in the Hegelian sense that, you know, you might be negating some things about the past, but you're also taking them up. You're rereading them in a fuller and more inclusive way. And I think that this is just what we really have to do. You know, when you look at, you know, the church needs to find a way that is more open and accommodating to gays and lesbians, and a way to incorporate women into the decision-making structure of the church. These are what, as William James used to say, you have to do this, and as Dan just said, you have to do this in a way that creates the least amount of pain. In other words, you have to go down into your tradition and find some kind of roots that allow you to make that move. But, you know, as Charlie said, then you have to, Richard just said, you have to admit that this is not perhaps the way we've always done it, you know, but but you at least have to say that these possibilities were always there, this potential was always there, and, you know, we're realizing God's plan in a fuller and more perfect way now than we were in the past.
Charlie?
I think those are good. I'm totally on board with the whole idea. We've got to be able to face it head on, and I think the statements continue to be there. You know, the question you originally asked, Dan, you know, about President Uchtdorf, I think he is leaving the door open probably a little more than some of the others. You know, we heard some of the other talks where they dug their heels in a little deeper and were resistant and kind of putting forth the idea of, hey, these are eternal doctrines, they're not going to change, you know, et cetera. But I think that's the kind of discourse we got to slowly move away from.
Right. And you even addressed that, Richard, as, you know, why are they digging their heels in on this kind of stuff? Because the church is, like, built upon revelation, and how to say that, you know, things can't change is just
insane. Yeah, this is what I call this the paradox of the 8th and 9th articles of faith. And the paradox seems to be something, it's this paradox between having a settled set of teachings and an open canon. And there's this tension. Nice. There's no getting away from it, that we have what we have. We have a kind of settled foundation on which everything is built. And we recognize with this 9th article of faith that that all could be, in theory, this all could be undone in significant ways. Now, that's in theory, because then I stress theory, because in practice, we have very little revelation in the strongest sense of revelation, you know, radical revelatory change. This is pretty rare, right? It's happened once or twice since the time of Joseph Smith. So I think we're all hopeful, you know, that this kind of event will take place again, but it's certainly unusual. And maybe Uchtdorf could be helping prepare the way for some significant, more significant shifts. I don't know, but as long as you still have an Elder Oaks standing up saying what he says to kind of contrast this. I don't want to set that up like they're opposed to each other. I just want to say the two men as prophet, seers, and revelator represent very different sensibilities. So, yeah, I don't see them as, they're not contradicting each other, but they represent very, very different mindsets.
Well, guys, has everyone said most of the things that they want to say? Is there any big points that anyone left on the table?
Just one other last thought I had was just, I think all of this kind of discourse and the mindset that we have developed as a church also has a bearing on how we view other faiths that I think is unfortunate. And you know, I've made several allusions to that throughout this essay. And I think the concluding comment, the statement that it makes, does a similar type of thing where it concludes saying, again, we have something that is more powerfully motivating than what other faiths have. And I think what I'd like to see is something more along the lines of we rejoice and join with, you know, fellow Christians who view God as our Father, who feel the divinity within, who seek to nurture that, to be more godlike in all of our activities, rather than saying, you know, we're on a track that's so different from everybody else that it's unfortunate for the rest of the world.
Yeah, Charlie, nice. I would love to see it. I don't know how we would do it or if it could happen, but I would love to see the day when an essay like that actually takes the teaching of some other group. I don't care whether it's Christian or Buddhist or Hindu or Jewish. It doesn't really matter to me. Right. But take some of those ideas, and rather than showing why we have the, we'll call it one true correct way or the best way of understanding, what if we could take the ideas from some other religious tradition and show why they have something important to teach us? We can really genuinely learn from other traditions. So in other words, what I have in mind is Joseph Smith's universalist kind of approach to let's gather up truth wherever we can find it.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Nice. Yeah, there's a great line from Brigham Young that anything that's true, whether I can't remember how he says it, whether the free thinkers have it, whether the Presbyterians have it, everything that's true is for me Mormonism. So,
yeah, that'd be a fun podcast. Even I'll have to think of that one for the future. Just we'll try it. We'll model it for the guys. Back to final thoughts, Richard or Jim. Anything?
I think the only thing that I wanted to sort of throw out there, maybe as a final thought, is that, you know, clearly in podcasts like these, you hope that the audience will take them and think about them. But one of the things that I'm not entirely sure, well, I'm not at all sure about how some of these things that we're talking about, our hopes or aspirations or the things we would like to see, find their way into the discourse generally of Mormonism. It's not our job, actually, probably, to maybe even worry about that question as to how they find into the discourse generally. But maybe the best that we can do is to simply throw our voices out there however we can, and just simply having this conversation is as good as we can do. And then maybe if it comes up privately, it's as good as we can do. And maybe that's the best that we can do, is just whatever the circles are that we find ourselves in, to be willing to express these things in a way that's as constructive and productive as possible, you know, taking seriously the fact that there are genuine questions and serious tensions and sometimes contradictions, but trying to find ways to, my biggest concern is here is alleviating unnecessary suffering. And I think that this discourse of eternal and changing doctrine, I've seen it. I've seen too many people suffer from it. So I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm. It leads to the fragility that was in the title of your piece. Yeah. Awesome. Jim, any final thoughts from you?
Well, I just want to thank Dan, you, and Richard and Charlie for letting me participate in this. I tell Charlie, Coford sent me his book to do a blurb on it just before it came out, and I was going to just read a few pages here and there and then write something, and I ended up reading the whole thing, and now it's become a kind of bathroom book for me. It sounds bad, but
nice.
It's kind of, it's my version of Mormon doctrine. Whenever I just like to run to pick chapters out and read little bits and pieces here and there all the time. So thanks for writing it, Charlie, and people should buy this book and read it
for sure.
And then thanks for including me with this.
Loved having you. Thanks so much. Thanks to all you guys. I thought this was a great discussion, and I hope that it'll be something that'll cause people to think, and I hope everybody listens to this and shares this, because I think we raised a lot of important issues about how do we reframe this expectation of of doctrinal unity, and everybody throughout time had the fullness, and therefore any change is scary. Boy, I just love the unfolding kind of stuff. So anyway, thrilled that we could talk about the specific statement as well as these larger issues, and there's pros and cons, and proceed with caution and all that kind of stuff. So thank you. Listeners, please join in the discussion. I love having you come to the blog. I know a lot of you comment on Facebook, and it's great that happens there, but some of you spend a lot of time on Facebook comments, and I would rather have you do those over at the blog, because, Facebook thread may last a day or two, and they're hard to find later and all that kind of stuff, whereas if you do your conversation, or if you at least have something super substantive that you want to say or ask, and we'll get these guys to come on, and we'll respond, but do it over at mormonmatters.org. That would be the ideal location for it. So while you're at the blog, subscribe, donate, love it. Thank you for all of you who do this already, and just those wonderful surprises. I get these notices, and it makes my day to hear from good folks. The money is wonderful and so helpful at a time like this, but just the boost of faith that there's listeners out there that are finding something from the podcast is really a moving thing for me, and I appreciate that. So, guys, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Jim, Richard, appreciate being on with you. I've enjoyed getting to know you better.
It was a pleasure, Charlie. Good to talk to you again, Jim and Dan.
Yeah.
Good night, everyone. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.